Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The Black Lives Matter movement has transformed the national conversation on anti-Black racism in the United States. While most of the flashpoints have centered on police violence, the movement has raised its links to institutional racism and also creatively confronted politicians. The Black Lives Matter movement has links to the past, and yet it's quite unique. The injustices it tackles are similar and yet different. Navigating the history of the United States and the challenges facing the Black Lives Matter movement in a new book is my guest, Kianga Yamata Taylor, assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's the author of a new book, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Welcome to Uprising, Kianga.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, why did this movement, you think, emerge during the tenure of the first Black president?
I think there are a combination of factors. I think one is the kind of cumulative impact of policies over the last 20 to 25 years that really during what some perceived to be as the heyday of the American economy in the 1990s, in some ways led to greater rates of incarceration, greater rates of involvement with the police, an economic downturn at the beginning of the 21st century, sort of all came together in the last 7 or 8 years, I think, sparked by or catalyzed by, in some ways, the election of Barack Obama. And the way in which Obama's election raised the expectations, particularly of Black millennials, that his administration had the potential to be a break with the past, had the potential to be a deviation from those policies and practices of the previous 20 to 25 years. But I think very quickly, for many African Americans, young people in particular, Obama's administration represented more continuity than change with the past. And I think for a layer of young African Americans, it led them to protest and to organizing and a different kind of political outlook that didn't just begin and end with elected officials, but looked sort of beyond what was on offer to challenge the political status quo.
Before we get into specifically how the movement is navigating a very sort of complex set of layers of oppression, I want to actually talk about some of the nuts and bolts of it. I mean, Black Lives Matter is, fairly recent. It's a recent phenomenon, but there have been even before that other kind of groupings, maybe more localized groupings of young people at Dream Defenders in Florida that emerged around the killing of Trayvon Martin, et cetera. How do you describe the breadth of this movement? How big is it? How much do we know about how what its reach is within various communities in the United States?
Black Lives Matter at this point as a national movement. So there's the hashtag Black Lives Matter, which I sort of used to identify the organization, the national network that was launched by the three Bay Area activists, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tome. And so that, I think, is distinct from what has developed as the Black Lives Matter movement, as this kind of all-encompassing, almost umbrella movement that has drawn together disparate formations, individuals from different parts of the country into not necessarily a coherent movement with specific demands and goals, but people who identify common aspects of the struggle, perhaps most saliently around the demand to end police violence in Black communities. But I do think that this is part of a development that began with the murder of Trayvon Martin. In some ways, you know, we could look and see the earlier roots of this eruption of Black Lives Matter beginning in some ways with the kind of dual focus on Troy Davis, the very quick movement that tried to develop to save his life in September of 2011 that coincided with the eruption of the Occupy movement. And I think that both of those really opened up a much broader discussion about racial inequality and economic inequality and the overlap between the two that certainly gained momentum around the killing of Trayvon Martin in the spring of 2012, but then exploded regionally in the summer of 2014 with the killing of Mike Brown, and then became a national phenomenon in December of 2014, in the weeks after the failure to indict the police officer who killed Eric Garner in New York City. And so I think that this movement has expression in different parts of the country that in some ways have been organized around local demands that pertain to particular situations in particular cities, but that what unites them is an overarching demand to stop police violence. And so there are many ideas and different strategies, and I think that we've seen a range of tactics in how to confront the issue of police violence and police brutality. But I think that that is the kind of issue that unites the movement, even though there are all sorts of different ideas about the lengths that activists within the movement should go to confront that. There are different ideas about how to understand police brutality within a wider context of American society and much deeper and substantive critiques of U.S. society. So in some ways, the issue of policing in Black Lives Matter just begins to scratch the surface of a much deeper conversation about the perils of institutional racism and really raising big questions about the condition of Black life in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And so this the way in which this umbrella term, as you described, is fairly broad. It encompasses someone like the Baltimore-based activist DeRay McKesson, who's often described in the media as a Black Lives Matter activist. He's running for mayor of Baltimore. He's come under criticism from other activists in Black Lives Matter for being a Teach for America, for being a product of Teach for America and a proponent of charter schools. But speaking of charter schools, speaking of privatization, let's talk about that aspect. Let's talk about how our current economic system today is designed in a way to keep reinforcing institutional racism. And yet, it's very different from the Jim Crow era of the past. I mean, we have, as you point out in your book, enough sort of members of a Black political and economic elite that society can point to them and say, well, if they can, why can't others? Can you explore that a little?
Sure. I think that these are two of the more important developments over the last 45 to 50 years in Black life. One is the development of the Black political class, a small Black elite, is having really a different set of experiences compared to most Black working class and Black poor people. And so you get this chasm of having a historically high number of Black political representatives, you know, with the Black president and the Black attorney general being the most obvious examples of that. But, you know, there are more Black elected officials in the Congress than at any other point in American history. And yet we still live in a country where 40% of Black children live in poverty, where Black college graduates are three times more likely to be unemployed compared to white college graduates, where Black unemployment still remains almost twice that of white unemployment, where Black net wealth in the United States remains stuck at $11,000 compared to $141,000 for white families. And so despite this political representation, there are still massive cleavages that separate Black life from what goes on in the rest of the United States. And some of how that happens, those disparities, also has to do with the prevalence of colorblind racism in the U.S., where no longer is the issue the kind of intentional discrimination that marked the Jim Crow era of the United States. But really, you have places and cities where African Americans are concentrated, the slow attrition of public services that also contributes to this kind of degraded status Black life in the United States, often overseen by either Black elected officials or Black civil rights entrepreneurs who look to sort of cash in on conditions in American cities instead of combating them. And so to me, that this raises a new question about issues of solidarity and what future anti-racist movements will look like, where I think historically, because of the sort of overarching nature of racism in the United States, that there has tended to be a united Black movement, even fraught with political tensions and class tensions, that the overarching aspect of racism tended to pull African Americans together. Now, where you have, you know, situations like Baltimore, in every city, you know, in most cities in the United States, where you have a Black political elite who are actually overseeing the conditions of poverty, unemployment, exploitation of African Americans, it puts ordinary Black people in direct conflict with Black political operatives. And so that raises new questions about solidarity and about how the movements against racism, we have to look much more broadly and much more expansively. We have to look to make connections to the immigrant rights movement. We have to look to make connections with Muslim and Arab populations that are also under attack by the state in the struggle against Islamophobia. We have to look to the labor movement, really, where working class people of all ethnicities and races are under attack. And how can this movement link up with those groups? There's such a wide breadth of attack on ordinary people in the United States today that it raises great possibilities for those kinds of united actions, but they have to be actively sought out and cultivated.
Now, I'm wondering if you can kind of also explore this issue that often comes up, and sometimes comes up in a way that kind of divides activists from one another, and which is when we look at how racism kind of manifests itself in American society, there's a tendency among some to want to attribute it to entirely an issue of class, that slavery is explained by the fact that it was simply an institution that provided free, cheap labor, and that even today, you know, if we dismantled capitalism, racism would sort of die on its own. How do you see that view?
Well, I think that instead of looking at the categories of race and class separately, that we have to look at them in tandem with each other. You know, it's important to understand racism as a phenomenon of capitalism, which I think doesn't diminish the impact of racism, but helps us to locate what its origins are. Because otherwise, we end up with, to me, what is an inexplicable explanation for where racism comes from. How did it actually develop? But it's one thing to acknowledge its roots within the capitalist economy, both historically and I would argue also in the contemporary sense, but also understand its own sort of characteristics, that simply ending class oppression in the United States without addressing the issue of race is in fact impossible, because you would not actually be able to build the kind of united movement that would be necessary to challenge class oppression in the United States without dealing with the issue of race. And that means understanding what the composition of the American working class actually is. There is such a kind of stereotype of who the blue-collar worker is in this country. I mean, the fact is that the majority of Black people are working class. For that matter, the majority of white people, the majority of Latinos, the majority of people in the United States are working class, which means that the working class is a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-gendered group of people. And so those then become class issues. And so I think that one mistake that the left tends to make in swinging the other direction is to somehow think that because African Americans and other non-white people suffer particularly from racial discrimination and racism, that somehow issues of class are less important. But the, you know, in the US, 55% of Black workers make less than $15 an hour. In fact, Black workers are more conscious about their class status than even white people. And that is reflected in terms of a much higher rate of unionization among African Americans compared to whites. So Black people tend to understand how class issues are deeply related to racial issues in the United States, and that by separating the two, we actually make it almost impossible to combat either one. And so I think that we have to have a much closer understanding of how those work together, but at the same time realizing that without fighting racism directly, we'll never even come close to challenging the class oppression that goes on in this country.
The other very important sort of phenomenon in American society that has had such a deep impact on African Americans and on kind of disenfranchising economically, politically, African Americans has been the war on drugs. You know, in recent years, we've started to acknowledge that. Even officials have started to acknowledge that. With the marijuana legalization movement, we're coming to terms with it. But how important is it to sort of remind ourselves that this is the so-called war on drugs is actually a continuing phenomenon that continues to criminalize, you know, African Americans disproportionately? And why is that also central to our understanding of institutional racism in the U.S.?
The issue with the war on drugs and its impact in Black communities in particular has, in the last couple of years, has been sort of characterized as on its last leg, that, you know, even right-wingers like the Koch brothers are opposed to mass incarceration and are for the release of some prisoners for nonviolent drug offenses. And while I think in some situations this is true, that it's largely driven by budgetary crises in the different states in the United States, where the cost of imprisoning people has become so enormous that even conservatives who are in no mood to raise taxes to pay for the continued imprisonment of people from the drug war have agreed to some kind of early release for some people. But for the vast majority, in most cases, there is a conundrum that the right wing and even liberals can't get out of, which is if there is a commitment across the political spectrum, which in many ways I think that we can point to, against raising the kind of revenue, meaning raising taxes, to continue to pay for the public infrastructure in American cities, meaning public schools, public hospitals, paying for unemployment insurance, paying for really the social welfare of people who live in cities. If there's no commitment to that, then policing and jail and imprisonment become the solution to that. And I think that when we see the sort of intensification of policing, in aggressive policing, in the kind of approach to broken windows policing, in using the police as ways to raise municipal revenue, that we can see how that will play itself out, which is that there is almost no commitment to maintain public infrastructure in American cities. American cities are being reconceptualized and rethought as places for the kind of technology class of young people who are less reliant on public institutions. And for those populations, because of racism, gender discrimination, both historically and contemporarily, who exist on the economic margins of those cities, as they get pushed further out, then that begins to justify budget cuts to the public sector. And the way that the crises that inevitably creates is dealt with is through aggressive policing. So while I think that there is some talk of trying to reduce the prison population, mostly because of the cost, rarely attributed to the racism and immorality of the war on drugs and its horrific impact on Black people over the last 35 years, that these political, both conservatives and liberals, run into a problem, which is that they have no plan of how to govern a city in an age where no one will raise taxes and there's a competition between cities to attract this kind of hipster technological class of young white people, which means, you know, sort of reconfiguring the city away from social welfare towards sort of every person out for themselves, which excludes entire swaths of people.
I'm so glad you brought up those related issues as well. In the last few minutes of our conversation, first of all, I want to ask you, how does Black Lives Matter get to what you call Black liberation, the sort of all-encompassing idea that, that the civil rights leaders have been tackling for decades? I know that that's sort of an answer that you wrote the book for, but if you were to put it in a nutshell for our listeners.
One is the recognition that it's one thing to raise awareness about issues of police violence, which is obviously very important and has helped change the conversation in the United States from one of bad apples and rogue police officers to one of systemic issues dealing with policing in the United States. But I think for the movement, we also have to look deeper into questions about why does the United States rely so heavily on policing? Why, similar to what I was saying previously, is there such great investment in policing while simultaneously such little investment in other aspects of the public infrastructure like schools and hospitals and that sort of thing? And I think that once we start getting into those sorts of questions, it gets into really the political leaders and elected officials in our country talk about the police being here to protect and serve and to maintain order, then we have to ask what type of order is actually being maintained. And really, is there any sort of golden era of policing that we can look to as a point of reform? And I don't think that there is. And so that raises much more substantive questions about the nature of policing, the nature of American society. And I feel like when those questions are opened up, the issue moves much further beyond just reform of the police. It moves much further beyond issues of body cameras and sensitivity training. It moves towards what would it mean to live in a society where police weren't needed to maintain order in a fundamentally disordered and fundamentally unequal society. And so the last question with that has to do with, how do we go from that recognition to actually building the type of movement necessary to challenge the current order of the United States? And I write at one point, Black people want to be free, but we can't get free alone in the United States. We are 12% of the population. So the idea that Black people can get free alone is one that mathematically doesn't make much sense. But it's also sort of feeds into the idea that there's something unique to Black oppression. And the reality is that the United States is a fundamentally unequal society that has left all kinds of people locked out. And so how do we unite those different groups of people who have no vested interest in this society as it's currently organized? And I feel like making those links and making those connections is really the key to not just liberating Black people, but liberating humanity in general.
I'm also wondering, Kianga, what you make of some of the criticisms emanating from some radical Black commentators like Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon from the Black Agenda Report of the Black Lives Matter movement. I noticed that you've written for Black Agenda Report yourself. What do you make of their scathing critiques? Is there, are there valid critiques that the movement ought to, and people in the movement ought to sort of read and take seriously, or are these critiques just sort of far-fetched?
I don't think they're far-fetched. I do think that some of the critiques about what are the goals of the movement, how does the movement conceive of what it is actually building, what is the point of the movement? I think that some of these observations sort of have legitimacy and really speak to the urgency with which some people are holding in terms of what kind of lead or direction are the most prominent sort of organizers within Black Lives Matter as a national movement going to put forward, because thus far there have been very few. At the same time, I think that there can be a certain level of impatience that is not necessarily helpful. That what we, you know, have seen is that we've gone through one phase of the movement of kind of raising awareness, and we're into a different phase of the movement where I think that people, there has to be a kind of separating out of what are the different strategies that are being put forward. And I think a lot of that discussion and debate within the movement has been quite muddled, in some sense for good reasons, which is people don't want to be perceived as attacking each other. There's a tendency towards wanting to collaborate and work together, which I think is healthy. But I think that some of the reluctance to engage in substantive political debate about the nature of the movement and its direction can then have a kind of confusing impact where it's not clear what the different strategies are. And so the lines of demarcation become difficult for people to see. And so it raises questions. Well, does DeRay McKesson and Campaign Zero actually then represent the movement in the way that the mass media does? Or, you know, what is the Black Youth Project in Chicago, which seems radically different from what something like Campaign Zero puts forward? What's the difference there? Or, you know, the hashtag Black Lives Matter grouping network, what is it that they're putting forward? And so I think that there has to be an effort to more clearly delineate the different strategies and tactics that are being put forward so people know what they're supporting, people know what they don't support, and then people can organize themselves along those different lines.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Kianga, for joining us today. And we'll post a link to information about your book from our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. My guest is Kianga Yamata Taylor, assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. We've been talking about her new book, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation.